Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They get old. They need help. Dressing, medications, walks. They're more frail, but they still tell your favorite jokes. These people are now our parents, and you're taking care of them, maybe for a long, long time. According to the AARP, one in four adults in America is caring for an adult family member. Typically, they're not paid and don't even think of this as work, but the total value of their contributions equals $450 billion annually. This hour, On Point, caring for elderly parents. You can join the conversation. Is this your life? Tell us your story. You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from New York is Susan Reinhardt, Senior Vice President of AARP and Director of their Public Policy Institute. She's co-author of the recent report on the economic value of family caregiving, and there's a link to that report on our website at On Point Radio. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jackie. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome, because this report is fascinating, and I would like you to give us some of the headlines for it. You write that you're looking back at 2009, primarily, updating, of course, to the current time, and you say that over 60 million Americans are providing, is this uncompensated care? This is voluntary care at home for somebody.
That's right. That's one in four Americans. 62 million people in the United States are providing care, typically to, this is a 49-year-old woman, typically, who is providing care about 20 hours a week on top of their day job. And they're doing this on average of 5 years.
How can people not think of that as work?
It's a very good question. I think because they do this willingly, by and large, of course, and they love the person that they are providing the care to, and it often kind of creeps up. It's not always in a crisis. Sometimes it is. And they think of themselves as their husband and wife or son or daughter or neighbor or friend. And we would like them to understand that they are all those things and more.
I guess I was most surprised at the extent of this because, you know, there is some feeling, I think, that in our culture we do not put emphasis on elderly people or on age, say, the way other cultures do, or that Americans are too busy or too shallow, too self-involved to care for their parents. And this is absolutely the opposite.
Absolutely. It is becoming what we call the new normal. It's a fact of life, as we've been discussing. It's so many people. And we say one in four people today. That doesn't even capture the point that there will be more people in the future that are providing care. So while you may not be a caregiver today, you are very likely to be a caregiver in the future.
Talk about what a caregiver, an unpaid family caregiver, has to do.
Well, they do a lot of different things. They, for example, may be driving their, let's say, mother to the doctor. In fact, about 1.4 billion trips are provided by family caregivers a year, and that is interrupting the person's daily life, this caregiver's daily life, trying to do that. And of course, they're sitting there and often with the person at the doctor's office, so they become the coordinator of the care from this doctor to that therapist and from this hospitalization to this pharmacist. It's very complicated care. They may be providing help like personal care. They may be doing bathing and dressing. They are most likely providing some kind of a healthcare task like medications. And we're not talking one pill. We're talking many, many different medications that have different side effects. They feel obligated and probably should be very cautious about what side effects are occurring and prompting the doctor to maybe relook at these different medications. They may be injections. In fact, I often say that people, caregivers, are doing things that make first-year nursing students tremble. And I say that because I am a nurse, and I remember quite distinctly shaking as I was giving an injection to my first patient. My nursing instructor had to gently put her arm on mine and help me calm down. So we do this, we expect family caregivers to be performing these kinds of care tasks without giving them kind of the support and training that they need to do them.
Why do you call it the new normal? And who gets chosen to be the caregiver?
Well, I'll take the last question first. And very often it's the daughter. That's still true, although many sons are becoming more involved and certainly husbands are involved. They may be the one that's closest to the parent in this case, or they may be the nurse in the family. Certainly, they are the ones that are stepping forward also. There may be a division of labor in a family, I should say. So the daughter may be doing some things, the son may be doing something else, or another sister or brother. And that's a good situation when you have some workload to share. We call it the new normal because on top of the tasks that we think about that we were describing, you know, shopping, cooking, help with daily activities of daily living, there is this much more complex healthcare and long-term care role. Families are the core of both health and long-term care for their parents and other family members. And that care is becoming more complicated as people are discharged sooner from hospitals and often are rehospitalized and going to various different providers and doctors and nurse practitioners across a given period of time. So it's a lot to juggle. They don't have a lot of information for navigating all those different things that they're expected to do. And yet it is, quote unquote, the new normal.
Well,
it's expected.
Well, the other thing I think that we should point out is that the goal is to keep someone at home in most of these situations. Nursing homes are often terribly expensive. You may have doubts about how they're run. I'm not making this an across-the-board statement by any means. But I'm presuming, Susan, that for these people, you want to keep this person at home.
That's right. I mean, most people, about 95-96% of people whenever surveyed in this country say that they want to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
And typically that ability to stay at home is dependent on having others in your life that are willing to do these various kinds of things that you can no longer do for yourself or that you need some help to do. Families are that backbone of this long-term services and supports in the home.
I'd like to bring in now the voice of a family caregiver. Eileen DiGaetano joins us from Franklin, Connecticut. She and three of her siblings provide care for both of her parents who are in their 80s, and she's also a care manager at Connecticut Community Care. Eileen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me and for giving me the opportunity to participate in this program.
Am I saying your last name right?
Absolutely.
Great. So tell us, please, about how this transpired in your own life. You were also a nurse?
I'm also a nurse. I have a sister who's a nurse. My mother, who we're caring for, is a nurse.
Ah.
And I would say it evolved over time. As people age and abilities change and you're aware of the changes, in my family, we just started to recognize the necessity for support and over time began to support both of my parents in their own independence, which is really our goal, is to enable them to be as independent as possible and to support what they can do in their strengths so that their life is meaningful for them. So it's been an evolution over time, and certainly aging has brought some changes to their lives, and that's brought some changes to us as their supporters and their caregivers. In the last couple of years, I'd say things have speeded up a bit, and we have noticed that the needs for more complex care, more time in care, have certainly increased for all of us.
Now, one thing that you are fortunate to have, and Susan, I think probably not everybody has this, is several siblings who can kick in. This makes me think about the demographics down the road because families are smaller than they used to be.
Right.
But if you're in your 50s or 60s, you may still have a lot of brothers and sisters.
Well, there's seven in my generation. And we have the fortune of four of us who live close by. And there are four adult grandchildren who are also part of the actual caregiving tribe as well. And, you know, we were raised in a family that values family, that values serving each other and caring for each other, and that's just been a way of life for us. So it just seemed very natural for all of us to look for opportunities to see what each one of us could contribute to our parents as their needs changed.
And you were able to do this harmoniously, and it sounds like your parents are happy?
I think my parents are extremely happy. Harmoniously, there have been adjustments every step of the way. And, you know, I think for each one of us, we have looked at the process that has evolved. We're all in different circumstances. I have a brother who's an independent contractor, farmer. He has a two-year-old, so we know what that brings to life. And his wife is a self-employed massage therapist as well as a mother and taking care of farm duties. My other sister works three jobs, and so you know that her schedule is really full. And then I have another sister who's close by who has two teenage boys who are still in school and involved with all of the activities that go on with school and the running back and forth, and she is full-time employed as well. Three of us are single parents, so we're doing our own family things on our own. Fortunately, my children are grown.
All right.
And they've actually become part of the support system where, you know, I have a daughter who lives in upstate New York who has volunteered to, if my mother's care requires more support in driving.
Eileen, we're going to have to come back to that in the next segment of the show. We're talking about the challenge and expense of taking on a caregiver role for aging parents. Please join the conversation. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Susan Reinhardt. She's the Senior Vice President at AARP. That's AARP, the Association of Retired Persons, of course. And she's Director of their Public Policy Institute and the co-author of the recent report on the economic value of family caregiving. And we also were talking as we went out with Eileen DiGaetano of Franklin, Connecticut. She is a nurse and caregiver for her parents, who are 84 and 88. And Eileen, you were sort of enumerating as we went out. You've got quite an extensive sibling group taking, and even the grandchildren pitching in there, which is great. And your siblings are in pretty healthy age range, 43 to 57. Your parents are 84 and 88.
Yeah.
Even so, it sounds like, you know, boy, it takes a village. Corny, but true.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what happened to us recently. In April, my mother had brain surgery. She came home after major surgery 3 days after the hospitalization. And as Susan said, people are, you know, healthcare is changing and people are home with more complex needs sooner. Subsequent to her return home, all of the caregivers got sick. So we were trying to provide care, and I think we rotated for about 2 weeks trying to find someone who wasn't coughing or having GI problems. And it took every one of us. We had two parents with two separate needs, and we had two caregivers in the house 24 hours a day. I had a sister who came from Australia who came the distance because we needed, she wanted to be here for the surgery, but she stayed because she recognized the need for help.
So for both of you, I would like to talk about the gulf between the care, you're in the healthcare field, Eileen, the gulf between what a hospital can do and what is needed at home. And Susan, it sounds like just an enormous amount.
There is. And Eileen, I'd love to meet you. I'm one of six children myself. My parents are very lucky to have me. And I also have a nurse in the family and a social worker. This is highly unusual. I just want to point out, like 20% of older women today have no children. And also your description of the different things that you were doing, I kept envisioning if you had to hire someone to do all of that, that's how we come up with the $450 billion, which, by the way, is more than the annual total sales of Walmart. So this is enormous contribution that you're giving to your parents and to the country, because who could afford that if we did have to pay for all of what you're doing? So thank you, and congratulations to your parents for having such fabulous children and grandchildren. But to your question, Jackie, this is very different than it was years ago because healthcare is very different. We have much more technology. So people are not just going home, as I said, with a pill or maybe a bandage. They're going home with complicated care plans. And they often have equipment that is needed at home. And the expectation is that the family is going to help them do this. And they are not nurses. They are not typically nurses or social workers or physical therapists. They are people who are everyday people who have had no instructions. Typically, as you're leaving the hospital, you might get a list handed to you, if you're even there, by the way, that says, here are the medications and make an appointment with your doctor. The appointment isn't made already. That's something they expect you to do, and they expect you to get them there. And you don't know anything about these medications or these treatments, and there's no one who's going to be there to help you to do that immediately. So that's why we put this report out, so that we can make it really a big focus that we have to help family caregivers, healthcare professionals, every nurse, every social worker, every physical therapist, every doctor, everybody needs to look at that family caregiver as part of the team. And if we don't support them, big problems.
Eileen DiGaetano, we want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And let's take a call here. We're talking with Pamela from Orangeburg, South Carolina. Welcome to On Point, Pamela.
Thank you for taking my call.
Tell us about your situation.
The gentleman I spoke to before I got online, you know, I was telling him a few things about it, and he said, oh, well, this just does not sound good. Well, first thing, to get back on what you folks are talking about today, it is a challenge, and it is a big expense. When my mother finally got sick, they had saved all their lives, and they had plenty of money to bring in in-home health care. But in-home health care, and this was back in 99 when she died, so we're looking at 12 years ago, 24-hour in-home health care, you know, and that included an RN that dropped in once a month, or, you know, it was $10,400 a month.
It was $10,400 a month to hire an in-home health care aide. Was this just one person?
24-hour care. A registered nurse came in once a week. And us kids never said anything because we knew that Mom could afford it and all of us were working. And I was the only child that was close, and I was within 50 miles. And, you know, because we were raised, you know, pretty much our parents were independent.
I'm hearing a little frustration.
Oh, a lot of frustration. The first year, everything went really well, reasonably well, because Mom wasn't that sick. The second year, this girl came in from this company, and within the first 8 months that she was there, she got into Mom's Merrill Lynch trust account. Her and her husband wrote $37,000 worth of bad checks, 110 checks, as a matter of fact. Use the credit card for, you know, would go to, like, let's say a Walgreens to pretend to pick up medicine, but the medicine was never picked up, but the groceries and the toys and everything for this caregiver's family were bought. I mean, it took me, I had to quit my job and go on leave of absence. Well, I didn't have to, I just did. And finished up taking care of my mom until she died.
But so, Pamela, you had a very, very unhappy experience with a caregiver. And that can certainly happen, I suppose, Susan Reinhardt. Let's bring in Christina Irving. And, Christina, you are a social worker with Family Caregiver Alliance. We're speaking to you from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like people, of course, are going to have, they enter a new world, whatever is going to be out there, whatever the physical problem with the parents. Everything changes, doesn't it? Family, sibling dynamics, expenses, you're in new territory, a land you hadn't expected to be.
Yes, that's very true. And as Susan mentioned, for some people, it starts very gradually, and for other people, it may come on a little bit more suddenly. If there's a stroke or a fall, but things tend to be very different. So caregivers are dealing with a lot of changes and with a lot of uncertainty.
How can a family member, if they want to, Susan, jump in here. If you feel like you can't do it all at home or you're working, how do you avoid the kind of situation we just heard about? I mean, I suppose in any field someone can be unscrupulous, but Christina, can people be guided to social workers and caregivers and nurses who are paid, who are reputable and who the parent gets along with?
They can. That's a lot of what we end up doing at Family Caregiver Alliance, is really working with families to help them navigate through the system and find the resources that are going to work best for them. So it's talking with people about, how do you hire in-home help? How do you find someone that you feel is trustworthy, that your family member is going to feel comfortable with in the home? But it's not an easy process. It sometimes takes a trial and error, that you try someone out and does this feel like it's the right fit or not? And there's differences between going through home care agencies versus hiring someone privately, and who do you get the referrals from, and are background checks done? So it's a really complicated process, and it's a lot for families to try and figure out on their own. So it's really helpful for them to connect with resources in the community, social workers that they can talk to, people that can help them understand where do they go and how do they start this process.
Let's take another.
Jackie, yes. I just wanted to say something about Pamela's story that, you know, even though there was a person hired to be in the home, Pamela was nonetheless a caregiver and not, you know, calling herself as such, but monitoring, mm-hmm. as you could tell. And she was trying to figure out what to do. And these are her parents' wishes. How do you do that? And so part of what we are trying to get the message out is, when these things are happening, try to find where you can go for help. And there are. And I'm just going to offer something to your viewers as a couple of websites. The one that will reach you to, like, the Family Caregivers Alliance and local resources would be www.eldercare.gov. And okay. If you put in your zip code, it'll bring you to some immediate phone numbers that you can call. It's like an area and agency on aging. It might have different numbers. But it's very important to begin to look for help. And as you just heard from Christina, it may take a little time to figure out what's going to work for you. But there are sources of help out there. And the other one I was going to – oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to point out that we have your own report linked on our website, Valuing the Invaluable, 2011, The Economic Value of Family Caregiving in 2009. And that's
right.
On Point Media.
And I was also going to just mention the aarp.org/caregiving website that has some practical tools, like, what do you do about stress?
All right.
How can find help?
Okay, let's take a call here from Betsy in Litchfield, Connecticut. Betsy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have been the case manager, I guess I would say, for my mother with Alzheimer's for 3 years, and I started out as her only caregiver, and I was also working full-time. I had moved to her city to help her, and got a full-time job when she had early stage, and that absolutely did not work out, because as she, you know, got worse with the Alzheimer's, my full-time job was just too much. And it's just been a long saga, but in year three, we now have round-the-clock care. I'm the case manager, managing numerous people, doctor's appointments and so on, and my mother's not walking well. So you have to be by her side every second, because she can easily fall, and you can't tell her to not stand up because she can't remember. So, and it has fallen on me as the only female sibling. My brothers are not interested in doing any of the management or hands-on. So, you know, and this is an exploding problem, Alzheimer's. The only business that's doing well in my small town and expanding in Connecticut is the assisted living. They're expanding their dementia unit, and everything else in town is shutting down. So it just sort of goes to show. Also, I wonder nobody knows what causes Alzheimer's, and a couple of my mother's caregivers are from Kenya. And they say it's almost unheard of in Kenya,
well,
Alzheimer's.
Let's talk about the stress on you, Betsy. It sounds like there's a great deal of it. Christina, what sort of support can caregivers receive if they're feeling burnt out and worn down? And it sounds like we've already heard from two people, both expressed fatigue and frustration.
And that's really common for caregivers to experience frustration, to feel burnout, to feel overwhelmed with all the decisions and things that need to get done during the day for their family member. One of the greatest sources of support for caregivers can be support groups. It's talking to other caregivers. And there are in-person support groups. There are online support groups when you're in a more rural area or you can't easily get out to a support group. They're usually facilitated by a social worker or a case manager. So you get the support from the professional, but you also get the support from other caregivers, people who are going through the same thing that you're going through and really can understand it. It's really about connecting with the resources that are in your community and finding out what's out there. As Susan mentioned, the area agencies on aging may have programs and can be a great source to start. Our website, which is www.caregiver.org, has a 50-state navigator to help you locate some of those resources in your community. For some caregivers, they also need individual counseling, and it may not be long-term, but something to get you through this initial period of uncertainty, through this very difficult time, and help you develop new coping skills and strategies that you can use.
All right.
I think most caregivers would love to have a long-term break, but it's finding ways to get those short-term little breaks, things that are still meaningful for you in your life.
Let's go to Elaine from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Elaine, we just have a few minutes in this segment. Hey. Hello, welcome.
Yes, hi, Jackie. Thank you for taking my call, and it's a really important topic. And being a caregiver has been one of the hardest experiences of my life by far, and nothing prepares you for it. And it literally happened in an instant to my sister and I. My parents are independent for a very long time, and literally in a second, that just all changed. And I think one thing that I know from my experience and from those of my friends is that sibling relationships are really strained by being caregivers. And I know people whose relationships have been irreparably damaged or just really pushed to the breaking point by the stress of caregiving, the constant crises and emergencies, and having to divide up responsibilities. And another thing that I found very difficult is that, you know, a parent in failing health, the process of their health is not often a smooth one. That with my father in particular, we've had what I call many near-death experiences with him, mm-hmm. where he's all of a sudden, you know, rushed to the hospital and they say he's not going to make it, and then he does. And this has happened a number of times, and that is extremely stressful when you're constantly, you know, thinking the person is going to die and preparing yourself, and then it doesn't happen. So those are two of the aspects that have been particularly stressful.
Elaine, could I just ask, are you in some sense, though, happy that you can be at home and keeping your father at home?
He doesn't live in the same city as me, but yes, it is a great thing that he has been able to be at home and we have been able to get good aides to care for him.
All right. Well, this is a topic that I think is going to... how many Americans, Susan Reinhart?
62 million a year.
Did that surprise you, that number?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
No, because I've been a nurse for quite some time and a community health nurse, so I see it all the time. What surprises me is that people don't really understand that they are a family caregiver. It took me a while to really grasp how many people don't understand that they deserve to be recognized as someone who is providing this kind of critical support and that there are places to go.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lighten, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Christina Irving, a social worker at the Family Caregiver Alliance in San Francisco, and with Susan Reinhard, Senior Vice President at AARP. And let's take a call now from Audrey. Audrey, you're calling from Hull, Massachusetts. Hello, welcome.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for taking my call. I took care of my mom following a massive stroke for 9 years and my dad prior to that for 4. And unfortunately, their illnesses coincided with my graduating from business school with an MBA from MIT Sloan and embarking on a career in New York. And I pretty much got, unfortunately, derailed by virtue of the fact that I was the youngest of 4 children and the only girl, as somebody else had mentioned. And my mom's care necessitated my moving back, and I didn't put my career on hold because, to be honest, the emotional impact of that would have
probably impacted my relationship with her, but I chose to get 24-hour care, but it did become at least a part-time job, and I've actually had discussions with that about my colleagues and friends because many of them are going through it now. I lost my mom a few years ago, but the financial impact was, and I'm a financial advisor now, and financial impact on me was pretty close to devastating, and I'm just, after, you know, she's been gone for 4 years now, I'm just trying to pick up the pieces, and I've moved on with my career. But people don't plan for these things, and unfortunately, many times as our population is able to help people age and live longer lives, my neighbor's 103 and has complete clarity of mind, but as a caretaker at home. But my mom needed 24-hour care after her stroke, and there was no insurance, and there was no planning for that. And I had to be very resourceful about how I handled her affairs, and my siblings were deeply resentful, and it caused a huge divide. But when you're in the situation, you do what you have to do, and you very much, you know, there are resources available, as some of your colleagues on the show have been saying, but it takes a lot of time and effort and energy to research and find the right alternative, even among caregivers at home.
Audrey, I just have a question for you. As a financial advisor, I would imagine that you now tell, or do you tell clients that this is something that they have to plan for?
Absolutely. It's not just funding. It's thinking through who owns the house, whose name is it in, what if you outlive your spouse, which of your children or friends do you want named as a healthcare proxy or having the power of attorney. It's crucial because when you're in a crisis, it just all becomes so much more emotional and complicated. It takes a huge toll on people, and they're not prepared for it in most cases. And it's very, very hard to live through.
All right. Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us, Audrey. Susan, she brought up a couple of things about planning for this. And perhaps, you know, we had mentioned several websites. People should read those when they have a chance.
Absolutely. I really appreciated Audrey sharing that story and emphasizing the idea of planning. Plan for yourself, frankly, all of us right now, no matter how what your age is, to think about what you imagine your life could be in your own home, for example, assuming you would imagine staying there, and most people do. What can you move around in your home? What if you needed a wheelchair? Could you navigate all of that? In your neighborhood, could you get to resources? Could you even get food in the house? What would that take? Who are your neighbors and friends? What are your relationships like with people? We have another whole thing on planning for long-term care, and it's called Decide and Plan and Share Now. What you think you would want to do, plan for that financially. Audrey also talked about those important legal documents like advanced care planning and decisions about the use of technology in the future, should you want it. All of those decisions should be made early in your life so that those who will be there when you need them understand what your preferences are. And it should start with having those conversations with the people who are going to be there for you, that you hope are going to be there for you. And I just want to say one other thing, and that is about social isolation. Very often people become isolated as caregivers, and they don't feel they have people they can call on, even to get a break. Like, could you come and stay with my mother for a couple of hours so I can go to a movie or something? It's not all about the government. It's also about our own personal relationships. And one way to think about this is developing your own social network for the future. And it might be volunteering in your own community now, so when the time comes for you to call upon those resources, they know who you are.
Okay.
I just think that's an interesting idea.
Thank you, Susan. Let's take another call from Vijay from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi, Jackie. My question was that if the quality and character of the care that is so crucial to caregiving, that is, then do we as a society have a responsibility to offer services like psychotherapy free of charge to encourage caregivers to learn more about how to give the best quality of care? Because already caregivers experience more than $7.5 billion in healthcare costs each year due to conditions like psychological stress. that is, the same stress, which might discourage them from spending even more money to learn about the disease, which could affect the quality of care. So do you feel that offering services like psychotherapy would be beneficial?
Offering psychotherapy to caregivers, well, I think that you have already mentioned doing something like that, Christina, urging people to, Susan just mentioned isolation a little while ago. I mean, that can happen, and people's health can deteriorate, can't it?
It can. You know, a lot of times caregivers, the focus is on the person that they're caring for and how best to take care of them and what their needs are. And a lot of what we end up doing is trying to turn caregivers around to think inwardly about how are they doing? How's their health? Physical health, emotional health, mental health, and realizing that that's just as important, that they really need to take a look at how they're doing and connecting with resources that support them, not just things that help their loved one.
Let's go to another call here. We're going to go to Bob from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to On Point, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Tell us your situation.
I have an interesting story that fits right in line with two of the points that you're trying to make. Second one is probably a little interesting twist that maybe you haven't thought of, but I and my sister provided home care. Essentially, we allowed my parents to die at home as per their wish. My sister is a nurse, and she afforded the medical care, the nursing care, and I was the muscle that that moved my father, especially my father, because he was a bigger person that overwhelmed my sister, and I had to essentially be there around the clock just to do that movement to the bathroom, so on and so forth throughout the day. I had to give up my life. My sister, even more so, gave up her life because not only did she hold down the full-time job and take care of the on-site care of my parents, her health went downhill. In fact, after my parents died, she eventually fell victim to a cancer that I think was because of her immune system being so severely stressed during that period of like 2.5 years of taking care of my parents. They died in very quick succession. I lost my health to a degree too because during one of my father's short visits to a hospital for an infection, he brought home, I believe, a hospital-borne infection, and that went right through me. It nearly laid me out flat. Because I was in such close contact with his bodily fluids, moving him and so on, I was probably the most severely affected in the family. And I was in perfect health before that point. I know the day it happened, the moment it happened. Afterwards, I developed really severe heart problems that severely limited my lifestyle as a result.
Well, Bob, having looked at this, would you do it again?
Oh, absolutely. It was for my parents. I don't look upon it as I certainly bear no ill feelings towards them, but it was like I'm 63, so it was that old style of thinking that we have an obligation to our parents and we take care of our own.
Well, and obligation.
They didn't want to die in a hospital, and my sister and I gave them that opportunity to die like they wanted to.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the things I don't want to lose in this conversation, and I think Christina and Susan might agree, it's an enormous obligation. You just underlined some extraordinary rigors. But there are rewards to providing to people who have hopefully provided to you, or even if they haven't, knowing that perhaps this is doing the right thing, or seeing people pass away with dignity and happiness. And we talked at the beginning of the hour. These are the people who are the keepers of the family talking sticks, aren't they, Christina? I mean, you want to give them the best in many situations.
It's true. You know, this is something that most caregivers take on voluntarily. For a lot of the adult children that we work with, they say, well, they raised me. This is my parent. They took care of me for so many years. It's my turn to return that favor to my parent, and I want to be there for them. For some families, it's a chance to be able to get to know their parent better. For spouses, you know, it's the till death do us part, and for partners as well, this is a commitment that they've made, and they want to be there for that person and enjoy that time with them. It, again, there's that balance. It's recognizing all the rewards and things that you enjoy about caregiving, but also allowing yourself to experience and have support around the things that are more difficult and challenging.
Susan Reinhardt, let me ask you a policy question here. A lot of baby boomers do go through everything from, you know, IRAs to college expense accounts to try to provide care for their parents. What happens when the money runs out?
Well, the person themselves, let's say their parent, may become eligible for other public support like Medicaid. Once you spend the person's money, not your money, but the person's money, spending down, we call it, they will be entitled to Medicaid payment for long-term care, typically in a nursing home. But different states determine whether that person could also get that kind of care at the home instead of a nursing home. So that varies across the state.
So sometimes you can access a payment or a person through Medicaid who would come to the home?
That's right. But we're not talking 24-hour care. Typically, it would be more like a few hours a day. That can be very, very helpful. But they could do the bathing and the dressing and some of the more heavy kinds of tasks that might be needed, which might be enough to help somebody not go to a nursing home. But when the demands are that are actually requiring 24-hour care that Bob was just describing of lifting, although I don't know, Bob, whether you had equipment, for example, that could help you lift somebody, then you may need to consider other options of residential care like assisted living or a nursing home. You really do have to consider, of course, the love that you have for your parents, but also what effect it's having on you and others in your family, and make decisions, but it's got to be around a conversation that puts all of those things together.
Well, and then, of course, you have to hope to have enough harmony to have that be a stable conversation, don't we, Christina, that as well?
Yes.
Let's take another call. Kim is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Kim.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. The thing that I wanted to discuss was the whole legal system. My sister and I were appointed guardians for our mom, which is a huge responsibility. She's in a senior residence now. She's 93, suffering from dementia. And Adult Protective Services came to us and said that something had to be done in her domestic environment. So we had to go to court. I won't get into the whole soap opera as far as
We just have a couple more minutes here.
Yeah, okay. But the thing is, we just negotiating everything with all the experts, we're finding out that it's so much just trial and error because no one really knows how to deal with these issues. As far as dealing with, you know, an aging parent and the whole legal system as far as being a guardian. So, you know, we dealt with clergy, we dealt with lawyers, we dealt with social workers, we dealt with Adult Protective Services. It's tough.
So let's talk about the policy implications here, Susan. If, in fact, long-term, more people are going to be aging, they're going to live longer, and smaller families are going to be taking care of these people. Where does that leave us?
I think it leaves us with the professionals, for example, lawyers that you were just referring to. I've been talking about healthcare professionals, social workers, et cetera, that we all have to be trained and better prepared to support family caregivers across these various areas that you've been raising, health, legal, financial. It's not typically part of any curriculum, frankly. It's barely in a nursing curriculum on how to deal with any of these issues. So we really, as a society, need to reframe how we are preparing those who need to help older people and their families.
Christina, would you agree?
Definitely. I think there needs to be a lot more training on how to support older adults and a recognition of caregivers and the pre-planning that needs to be done. Oftentimes, some of these challenges can be avoided when families do have the conversations early on and get the legal planning done, but we don't talk about that in general.
It has to happen while parents are still healthy, then, is what you're both saying. It really should be part of the conversation. I don't know, what, the parent turned 60, 70? Whenever.
Well, I would say yes, but also for yourself in your 40s. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody should be thinking of a future, and because this isn't always when you're 60. People do have serious, debilitating, chronic conditions. Half of the people with chronic conditions are under the age of 60. So it's something you need to be thinking throughout life.
All right. Well, thank you both very, very much for joining us. We've been talking about the policy implications and the personal implications of what happens when parents grow older. People are living longer. We have more and more people in their 60s and 70s taking care of parents. And you can continue the conversation and get our On Point podcast. Susan, did you want to just reiterate the website that you were trying to give earlier?
I mentioned the aarp.org/caregiving website, but also the eldercare.gov website, where you can put your zip code in and find more local help.
And your website, Christina, that you had mentioned?
Family Caregiver Alliance's website is www.caregiver.org. There's a 50-state database, and there's also a lot of fact sheets, things on legal planning, understanding dementia, self-care for caregivers, and all those topics. And so those are free for families to download.
And there's a lot of books out there, I think, too, that people might avail themselves of. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. We've been joined by Christina Irving, who's with the Family Caregiver Alliance in San Francisco, and Susan Reinhardt from AARP in New York City. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.